KALW.
You can't get rid of American Cycling. This place is famous. This place is legendary.
San Francisco is a forward-looking city with a strong sense of its past.
You always hear a little hammering, a little tinkering. It's a craft. It's artistic.
Today, we'll go on a tour of some of the institutions that have lasted, impacted, and changed the city over time.
I was shocked at how few women had worked here, and also that, like, you know, the very first curator of color was from the 1970s.
We'll go from San Francisco's oldest science museum to the nation's first suicide hotline.
We need to have that lightness within ourselves so we can share with others that it's going to be okay.
Oldest San Francisco. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is a special episode of Cross Currents. Today, we're going on a special tour of San Francisco. We'll visit four unique spots that have a lot of history and staying power. Each of these legacy institutions were featured in Alex Scott's 2023 book, Oldest San Francisco, and they were reported on by KALW's current Audio Academy fellows. From Model Ts to electric vehicles, Alioto's garage has seen and worked on it all. For more than 80 years, members of the Alioto family have perfected the craft of auto repair. With several shops dotted around the Bay Area, their mission location is where it all began. So let's roll into the oldest auto shop in San Francisco. As you enter the shop on Folsom Street, you can see cars in various states of disrepair lining the walls. There are a handful of technicians, some doing custom paint jobs and others replacing tires.
You always hear a little hammering, a little tinkering, you know, a little tapping. It's a craft. It's artistic.
That's Chris Alioto. He and his brother Matthew are the third generation of Aliotos fixing cars in the Bay Area.
We started in 1939 in San Francisco.
On Folsom Street in the Mission.
It was started by my grandfather, Frank Babe Alioto, because he had a baby face, and then passed to my father, Frank Alioto, and then passed to my brother and I.
Growing up, Chris remembers tagging along as his dad worked Saturdays.
My dad did everything. He took in the vehicles from the customers. He helped negotiate the claims. He washed the cars. He swept the floor. I saw him leaving the house at 6 in the morning, coming home at 7, 8 o'clock at night. He lived and breathed this collision repair industry.
And he started at an early age.
My dad had to give up a lot of the stuff that most of us take for granted. He did not get to play sports because every day after high school, he had to go work in the shop. He worked on weekends, was not allowed to take vacations.
And when Babe died unexpectedly, Frank had to step up to take the reins in order to support the family. But it wasn't all work. Christmas time was especially festive at the garage. Chris Alioto remembers the extravagant parties his parents would throw.
They were so much fun. For a week before, my father would close down the entire shop and he would decorate balloons all the way up to the ceiling with a dance floor. And we had like a tiki themed bar that we kept upstairs that we would bring out. And the frame racks that usually had cars on them would have nice tablecloths with shrimp, and everyone would be eating off of them.
It was a time to celebrate and schmooze.
Everyone was invited, you know, insurance companies, insurance adjusters, of course. Anyone whose car we fixed was invited. As much as my dad was constantly focused on the business, he could stop the entire business for a week for a good time.
But the brothers didn't always get Christmas time, Frank.
He was so tough that when I started working in the business, I wouldn't call him Dad at work. I called him Frank. And even though we carpooled together, he was Frank Alioto until we got in the car to go home. And then he was Dad again.
Eventually, Chris and Matthew went from watching their dad work to working with him.
He wasn't a very communicative person with his words, but a little nod from him was him trying to express his feelings of love. So he did an amazing job giving my brother and I an opportunity to build on what he and my grandfather started.
So when Chris and Matthew were ready, they ran the business their way.
One of the great things about working with my brother is that we're completely different people.
Like two sides of the same coin. Matthew is the mechanic, Chris is the people person.
He used to joke that he would go and fix a problem for a customer on their car and they may not be happy. Where I could talk to the customer, not fix the problem on their car, and they would give me a hug.
They opened up 7 more locations in other San Francisco spots, in Daly City and Marin County. The brothers have seen a lot of shifts in the city and in the industry.
These cars are giant computers these days.
So, is there a fourth generation of Aliotos ready to take over the business? Well,
my brother has 2 children, 2 boys. I have 3 children, a boy and 2 daughters. And we'd like to see if they have an interest in the industry, but in no means would we want to force it on them.
For now, Chris is just enjoying running the shop with his brother. That story was produced by Anthony Ivey, Aaron Lim, and Yosmai Del Mazo. Next up, the California Academy of Sciences, or Cal Academy, looks like it was plucked from the pages of a science fiction novel. It's both a 170-year-old museum and a working research institution that's on the cutting edge of science discovery. Let's jump into the heart of it with this story.
I'm really nosy. I would read my sister's diaries all the time. And honestly, as an archivist, you're allowed to read the most personal letters or journals or diaries, and it's okay, right? No one's going to give you a hard time or be mad about it.
Rebecca Kim is dynamic, passionate, absorbing, and inquisitive. She's the current head librarian at Cal Academy. That's where she organizes the archives, digitizes collections, and contextualizes the history behind the museum's artifacts. An important part of her work is about addressing truths about the museum that have long gone unacknowledged.
The history of science and the academy bundled together is rooted in like racism and colonialism and imperialism. And I wanted to be very like honest about those early and sort of current trends. So we're gonna swing by Monarch, which is right in this corner.
Monarch was one of California's last grizzly bears. He was kept in a cage in Golden Gate Park.
And so he here is like shown as a symbol of California, but also California grizzlies are extinct. And they know, you know, and he's a story of also conservation. How do we live with animal wildlife?
Monarch's story speaks to conservation.
European settlers drove California grizzlies to extinction in like 70 years after like they arrived, so very, very quickly.
And his story also speaks to colonization and the way the settlers treated native people whose populations were also decimated.
Like bears, indigenous people were seen as threats to like livelihood of European settlers.
When Rebecca joined the museum 7 years ago, she says she was shocked to learn that despite the great diversity in the museum's archives, the museum's staff was historically not that diverse.
I was shocked at how few women had worked here, and also that, like, you know, the very first curator of color was from the 1970s.
Rebecca believes that facing the legacy of colonialism and racism at the academy is a way to learn from the past to create a more equitable future in science. That's why she's so interested in the untold stories of the people who've kept the museum alive since 1853 in its multiple locations, first in the financial district, then Fifth and Market.
And that is where they are until 1906, which there's an earthquake and fire, which destroys the building and the collections.
The whole collection might have been lost if not for Alice Eastwood, an intrepid, self-taught botanist and museum curator. On the day of that earthquake,
she makes her lunch, she goes down to Market Street and tries to salvage as much material as she can
from the botany collection on the fifth floor.
And the staircase had fallen apart, so I don't know exactly how she got up to the very top, but she gets to the top and then she bundles the specimens and like lowers them down on a string or some sort of twine down to the ground floor where somebody else packs them into a wagon.
Alice does this to a great personal sacrifice. As she's saving the museum's specimens, her home burns in the fire that follows the earthquake. Today, the museum has a huge number of scientific specimens, around 48 million. They date all the way back to 1853. Another key person in the history of the museum is Toshio Asada. The scientist and artist made watercolor paintings that enhanced the museum's extensive Galapagos collection, which is the largest in the world. Toshio Asada worked as an illustrator for the Steinhardt Aquarium. During the 1930s, he was hired on numerous private expeditions to the Galapagos to make photographic prints and watercolors of collected specimens while also collecting fish specimens for the Academy.
It was before color photography was a thing, and so you can see what the color of that fish would be. And then in the jar there, you could see what a preserved specimen looks like. It loses all its color, so the watercolor would have been the only way to see what it would look like alive.
Like more than 120,000 other Japanese Americans, Toshio Asada was incarcerated in a so-called internment camp.
It's a part of his life that he segregated from his, like, work life.
He never spoke about it at work, never wrote down his feelings.
But, yeah, it's something that, like, you know, resonates as a Californian, as a person of color, thinking about those kinds of experiences, also wanting to know what he thought.
To Rebecca, documenting these stories is an important part of moving the work of the museum forward. It's also a way to encourage the next generation of scientists and curators to do this work. That story was produced by Clara Kamunde and Leon Morimoto. Our next story, we head to an undisclosed location in downtown San Francisco, to a nondescript building where people are saving lives through compassionate listening. This place is home to the oldest suicide hotline in the city and the country.
13th floor.
We take an elevator a few floors up to a room filled with light.
There's lots of light coming in. We've got plants scattered throughout the office to make it feel more like home.
Andrew J. Wickrame explains, in this space, people share the darkest moments of their lives. This is the Office of San Francisco Suicide Prevention. Andrew is the hotline's manager.
We do a lot of laughing here, and it can be like a little odd, like, why are all these people laughing here at a suicide hotline? We need to have that lightness within ourselves so we can share with others that it's going to be okay.
It's a far cry from the organization's first office, which opened in 1962.
Picture a red telephone in a basement of a Polk Street tattoo parlor in San Francisco.
That's Van Hedwall, director of programs.
It became the lifeline for those contemplating suicide all in the Bay Area and San Francisco.
Nothing like this had existed before. A man named Bernard Mays answered the distressed callers.
A gay, British, Episcopalian priest and correspondent reporter for the BBC.
In the 1960s, San Francisco had some of the highest rates of suicide in the country, and Bernard Mays was alarmed. He established SFSP as a way to counteract the trend. He put the hotline's number on matchbooks and distributed them to bars in the Tenderloin. Soon, he was training the first cohort of volunteers and moving the hotline from the basement of a tattoo parlor into an actual office space. Like a lot of the staff, hotline manager Andrew J. Wickrame started out as a volunteer in 2018. The hotline never records its calls, and they wanted us to respect caller privacy, too. But Andrew was able to describe a call that stuck out to him in those early days.
I pick up a call, and the person's on the phone. Their voice is really quiet. They're very serious. They're very somber. They're pausing a lot. You can tell there's a lot of thought going on. And he had just told me that he wants to end his life. And he's telling me these hurtful things that have happened to him in his life. And he's describing how alone he is. And I remember telling him, you know, well, you sound like a really nice person. And I'm sorry to hear you're going through that much pain. And I'd like to get you some help. I didn't say anything special. It was just what I genuinely felt in that moment. And he goes, yeah, I guess I should probably go to the hospital. And I go, I would like that.
Andrew was struck by how powerful it was to be present for someone in a moment of crisis.
There's this magical moment where you can feel they're taking it in. They're hearing again, almost for the first time, oh, I'm valuable. I'm not a bad person. They're getting a different message. We have the opportunity to give people a message that they've never had before.
Like Andrew 5 years ago, most of the people staffing the phones here are volunteers, hundreds of them. There are four cohorts of volunteers who get trained every year. Supervisor Quakey Sammy works with volunteers to triage calls and prevent compassion fatigue. She says one of the main focuses of the hotline is being culturally responsive to the diverse population of clients who call in from San Francisco and beyond.
We do get calls, international calls, and a lot of calls from the South. When we do outreach, we so desperately want and need people of color to volunteer.
Because speaking to someone who has similar experiences to you or speaks your language can be huge for someone who's feeling misunderstood. But Quakey says the most important thing a volunteer can do is just be there.
It takes courage to call, and it takes courage to pick up the phone, to answer the call.
The San Francisco Suicide Prevention Hotline is 415-781-0500. That story was produced by Crystal Rahim and Demetrius Johnson. From downtown, you can jump on a bike to ride the Wiggle. It's a popular cycling route from Market Street to Golden Gate Park, where we're headed to for our next stop. The SFMTA counted nearly 5 million bikes in San Francisco in 2022. The city is a haven for cyclists, and there's one place in town that's been keeping them rolling for nearly a century. Next, we're putting on our helmets and riding over to American Cyclery to learn more about the oldest bike shop in the city. There's a kind of soundtrack at American Cyclery, a steady thrum of tools, bike bells, and chains.
Right now, you can hear the air compressor going off, which we fill up a lot of tires and give a lot of free air away in the community, so our pumps are always going. There's a sound of shifting of gears. If it's adjusted correctly, it goes click, 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 click.
That's Bradley Wool. He's the third owner of American Cyclery. It's a job he never expected to have. Originally, he was an avid biker and patron of the shop. He ran a magazine called The Bicycle Trader, which helped connect bike sellers with bike buyers. And one day, he got this call from a well-known bike retailer that he was hesitant to name.
They asked me, hey, can you come down here and help us liquidate this store? And I said, hey, you can't get rid of American Cyclery. This place is famous. This place is legendary.
American Cyclery was established in 1941 by Oscar Junior. Junior was a popular cyclist in the early 1900s. He competed in events like the six-day race, where teams of two would take turns biking and resting over the course of the week-long event. Junior won the Los Angeles race in 1937, just 4 years before he opened up the bike shop.
Oscar was able to repair things in ways in today's world where you don't repair things, you replace things, you don't fix things, you sell people new things. Oscar really knew how to make something last a lifetime.
Before Bradley bought the shop, there were plans to turn it into a museum. If you walk in today, you get a sense for that history. Memorabilia adorns every inch of every wall. Bikes hang everywhere.
You look up here, these are like some of the holy grail bikes of earliest mountain biking days right here.
Imagine a time capsule that allows you to walk through cycling's storied history. From the 1920s, Bradley's oldest bikes, to modern high-tech mountain bikes, and everything from the 100 years in between.
But the most special bikes that I have here were raced by the original owner back in the 1920s and 30s.
Each bike tells a different story. To Bradley, that's one of the most exciting parts of doing this work, getting a sense for each cyclist and what they need.
I get lots of joy from being able to help a kid get his first bike or help a dad get his, you know, bike that's gonna help him do the Ironman.
Even past employees come by for visits.
Random stop through. Needed a part. It's nice to visit Brad and Ray.
That's Rana Hong.
I worked here from 2000 to 2003. And my time here was really great. I learned a lot from working for Brad and around these amazing vintage and modern bicycles. I learned everything I know about sales from Brad and a lot about the history of cycling. There are these amazing people that would come through.
Like celebrities.
I sold a number of bikes to Robin Williams and I got very friendly with him and knew what his tastes were and the kinds of things I knew he might like.
And cycling royalty.
One of our good customers is the announcer for the Tour de France. And we get his bike ready every year so he can go ride each stage of the tour ahead of the race.
However, it's not all bells and whistles.
If you look at the trending in America of how few children learn how to ride a bike, have any concept of what cycling is about, it's on the decline. Our goal is to help get as many butts on bikes as possibly can, starting at a young age.
In its 80-plus years, American Cyclery has seen other bike shops close or get bought out by corporations. Even Bradley got an offer.
They was interested in buying the store, but they weren't interested in buying American Cyclery. They just wanted my location, my cash flow, and my customer base. They weren't concerned about the history that's here, about the vibe of what this shop is. They just wanted another location to do what they do.
But it's more than just a business to Bradley. Biking, and especially fixing bikes, is about giving people the ability to go further with what they have.
There's great joy from repairing things, and it's a very calming thing to be able to take something that was broken or not working correctly and make it do what it was intended to do.
American Cyclery is undoubtedly a piece of San Francisco's history that's still standing.
Certainly is not an Apple Store experience.
That story was produced by Eliza Pepple and Jan Ramirez. All the places we went to today are featured in Alex Scott's book, Oldest San Francisco. The stories were reported by our current Audio Academy cohort, and this show was produced by KALW's Lisa Morehouse and Hanisha Harjani. You can find more stories from the series at klw.org/crosscurrents. And before we go, if you've ever wondered what it's like behind the scenes of our show, join us tomorrow night for Cross Currents Live. I'll be hosting a night of storytelling, poetry, music, and dance. It's a chance to experience your favorite Cross Currents features, and there's pizza from our friends at Joyride Pizza. Come connect with us, meet us all. We'd love to see you at Cross Currents Live tomorrow night, Friday, November 22nd. That's at 220 Montgomery in downtown San Francisco at 7 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.